Welcome to the Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. Joining me in the studios of CBS Interactive, Fleischmann Hillard's VP of Digital Media, Scott Rohde.
Hi, Tim.
And Radio, TV and Prints, Tracy Spicer.
Hello.
This week, former ACP editor Paula Joy's online launch, When Radio Goes Wrong, drama at Fairfax, and radio ad revenue back on the up, plus WikiLeaks. What does it all mean? Now, first we turn to Tracy Spicer. Now, Tracy, you're in the reason for chatting this week is that you're in the lunchtime chair at 2UE from next week right through until January the 14th. A satisfyingly alliterative press release, politics, parenting and principles, and not pulling any punches, which is always nice to get a tongue twister into a press release. Now, I'd imagine that talk radio must be one of radio's toughest gigs.
It's the greatest gig. It's a high wire act. I mean, it's exciting. And particularly with multimedia these days, we're getting a lot of venues, as you know, off Twitter and off the internet. So, look, I guess at 2UE they're trying to bring in a slightly younger audience, some slightly younger presenters, and it's exciting to be part of that, to bring Talkback Radio into a new age.
And for you, you've co-presented a few times. This is the first time in the chair on your own, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, that's right, and that's why I'm really thrilled about it, because I think one of the few glass ceilings left for women in the media is to be a solo female Talkback commercial radio host. It still is the shock jocks. There aren't many shock jockettes out there, if you know what I mean.
And do you think that's because of an audience's unwillingness to accept a solo voice, or is it just assumptions within the industry?
Excellent question. Being a small F feminist from way back, I always thought, oh, it's these dinosaurs, they never hire women. But having done a little bit of co-hosting, there is still a reticence on behalf of a lot of the audience, particularly this pocket of older women who are just accustomed to hearing a male voice and like to hear strong opinions from men. And some of the emails and letters and phone calls have supported that. They're like, look, you seem like a nice lady, but why do you keep talking? We want to hear the bloke. We want to hear what the bloke's got to say. So hopefully over the next, you know, 5 to 10 years, we'll see a change in that.
So you've got to be quite patient then.
Quite patient. Look, these things take time. Like women in television, it's a long road.
Yeah. So tell us about the style of the show then. How are you going to kind of present it?
Look, I've got a lot of issues that I'm quite passionate about, food security being one of them. I'm trying to dig up a few stories on that. I think there's a few hot button issues that I'd really like to press that affect all of us, but also issues that affect women. I think one of the legacies of not having many female talk hosts is that a lot of the issues tend to be a little male-oriented. So without burning my bra, I'd like to bring up a whole lot of issues that affect women, the work-family balance, to try to increase that crucial female audience.
Now, the thing that would always strike me is just the terror that you come on air and then the phones don't ring.
Oh, God, I'm having nightmares about that already. I'm bribing my friends to call up. Look, the good thing about 2UE is they've now got two Brennans on board. John Brennan, who's a consultant, who's 80, but incredibly passionate. And, you know, he's the god of talkback radio. He found Alan Jones and John Laws. He's got incredible advice. And his son, Peter Brennan, who's the program director now. So you've got two geniuses of radio working there. And they're really good at explaining what makes people call, which is basically appealing to people's passion. I mean, talkback radio is all about the heart. It's not about the head. I think that's a mistake a lot of people make by trying to over-intellectualise things. People are angry. People are frustrated, particularly in the city of Sydney, about a lot of things. And I think if you talk about things that people are upset or worried about, they're going to call. They want a voice. That's what talkback radio is all about.
And will it be too early to start talking about the state election, do you
think? Never too early. I'm going to have a countdown every day.
Which is worth doing. Now, I suppose one of the interesting things that 2UE is we're going to see a very different station next year. They've announced the new lineup, all but officially announced Jason Morrison. You've got Paul Murray coming in as well. So there's been lots of new faces. What do you think that kind of means for the talkback environment?
Look, I think it means two things. I think it's shaking it up. It's bringing in, like I mentioned before, that new generation, that younger generation. I mean, Jason Morrison really rocks. For a young guy, he does very, very well in the talkback environment. Same as Paul Murray. He's an incredible talent. So it's exciting to see these younger guys coming in who have got such a breadth of world experience and opinions and strong opinions. I think the problem where 2UE really, if I may humbly say, went wrong in the last couple of years is they didn't want presenters to have an opinion. They just wanted to take the middle line. And that works on the ABC, but people who listen to commercial radio want to hear polarising opinions.
They want something they can fight or argue about and talk to their friends about.
Precisely. Yeah. Like, I'm no fan of Pauline Hanson, but at least she polarised opinion. She got people thinking about where they stood, and I think that's an important role in talkback radio that has been forgotten.
Now, a bit earlier in your career, I think you did a fly-in-the-wall documentary on Alan Jones, didn't you?
I did! And
what
I learned.
What did you learn from that?
I learned an enormous amount. I learned that he does only sleep for 4 hours a night. And really, again, whether you agree or disagree with his opinions, and I disagree with a lot of his opinions, you've got to respect the man's intellect and the way the man taps into the psyche of the ordinary Australian. I think he's a genius in talkback radio.
It's funny you say that, because Thatcher was the same. She only had 4 hours sleep a night as well. It says a lot about the kind of the personalities that get born out of those hours of sleep, I tell you that.
Yes, that sort of special degree of psychosis is probably an unfair word.
Of right-wingness?
Yes, perhaps so. Yes, a certain element of conservatism that comes in the wee small hours. Now, I guess to a lot of people, you're still familiar as, you know, the face of 10 News, for instance. Which actually do you prefer, radio or TV?
Oh, I was talking to Tim Webster about this the other day. Without a doubt, radio. I mean, I feel privileged to have had, I guess, almost 20 years in television, which is a pretty long stint for a woman. That wasn't bad. But I find radio infinitely more intellectually stimulating, more exciting. And also, I don't know, maybe it's the control freak in me. I like the fact that it's just yourself and a small team, whereas TV is a vast number of people. I mean, look, I love doing Sky. You can do a lot of live interviews. I guess that's more stimulating than just reading the auto cue, which is essentially what I was doing at Channel 10 for all those years. So it's wonderful to be able to think.
Well, how do you think they're going to go with the big news lineup next year for 10? Because there's a lot of hours in that evening that they're going to be filling with news.
Look, there's a question about whether it's even going to go ahead at all now with Packer and Reinhardt and Murdoch on board. They're obviously building the infrastructure for it. I personally think it's a mistake. I know they're doing it because it's cheaper to produce half an hour of news than it is to buy half an hour of The Simpsons, even in repeat. But I just don't think they're throwing the resources at it. They've got big names like George Negus, who's terrific, Chris Masters, which is wonderful. A lot of the rest of it, though, is going to be staffed by video journalists who are a little bit less experienced. So I don't think it's going to have the quality and the polish that you would expect from a major public affairs or current affairs program. Mm.
Now, you've touched on being a woman in media. Actually, this is probably a good chance to bring in George. So George produces our podcast, so you're in your first year in journalism. George, I guess you actually don't have too many kind of role models to kind of look towards. Would you see Tracy as one of yours, do you think?
Yes, well, I guess I would. What advice would you have for someone like me?
My advice is to be tenacious. The media is a really difficult industry to get into and to build your portfolio of work or your career or your credibility or any of those things. And as a woman, you really do have to try twice as hard, especially not to be viewed as a bimbo, even in this day and age. I mean, I know we're talking about this a little bit later, but women are often sought after to do writing in the women's pages of the newspapers or in the magazines. I think it's important to expand your body of work outside of that to show that you do have an intellect.
I was looking through your biography and I was particularly interested in the work you did for World Vision. How did you get into that?
Oh, that was a favourite thing that I've ever done in my career. Look, fortuitously, someone had just heard that I was passionate about social justice and, you know, poverty in the third world, and they just called me out of the blue, a cameraman who'd done a lot of World Vision documentaries, and said, look, we'd love you to come on our next ones to Kenya and to Bangladesh, which was absolutely terrific to see the work that charities and NGOs are doing in those areas. I think from a personal perspective, it puts life into perspective. You realise, you know, what's right and what's wrong. It absolutely changed my life.
Now, speaking of women in the media, one of the other things I always like to ask anybody who sort of comes from, you know, sort of that background is, did you write Boned?
Oh, no, but I heard the other day that Jane Hansen did. I don't know whether that's correct, but I heard that from a very good source. So there you go. You can run with that as a rumour.
What did you think of it as a book?
I thought it was crap. And I
I'm glad you said that, because if it turned out you had written it and I said it first, then that would have been kind of awkward.
No, well, now you know I definitely didn't write it, because I wouldn't bag it that much. But no, I wrote an opinion piece at the time that it came out that I thought it just didn't ring true. Although if Jane Hansen wrote it, she was in newsrooms for a very long time. I think there's a better book to be written about women in television, something that digs a little bit deeper, because there still are barriers. There still is. It's not necessarily the glass ceiling anymore. Maybe it's perspex.
What are your own aspirations?
To be honest with you, I'm so thrilled to be able to be, you know, working in the print environment, online, on radio and in television all at the same time. I never thought that I'd ever be in this circumstance and be really comfortable. I mean, maybe I'm just not very good at any one of those and, you know, jack of all trades, master of none, but I'm really enjoying the variety of doing everything.
And is that a sort of deliberate strategy? This we talked of being a sort of portfolio career, this idea that actually, effectively, if you have several bosses, you have no boss.
It's a deliberate strategy, but not in that respect. Because I was in television for so long, and like I said, reading at AutoCue and feeling like I'd turned my brain off, I actually wanted to do some writing. That was one part of my career. A lot of journalists go from print into radio or television, but I did it the other way around. I wanted to build up my writing skills. I'd like to do a book one day. So it was a deliberate strategy to diversify my skills, really. And although I do enjoy the immediacy of radio, I think it's a precarious industry, and so long term, I think writing will be my future.
Well, next, we talk about Paula Joy, who looks to have put print behind her. So former ACP editor Paula Joy has joined the ranks of many former ACP editors and moved online. She launched her site Lifestyled this week. She posted a video in which she shared her trepidation.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to my site, lifestyle.com.au. This is a really big day. I've done a lot of things in my life, but this is probably about the most scary. I'm excited, I'm terrified, but I've turned the lights on and I'm sending the site out into the wild, just like one of my girls to school, and I can't wait to hear your reaction.
So that was Paula Joy talking about the excitement of the first day of Lifestyle. And I guess we're just beginning to see new sort of business models emerge where journalists are their own boss.
Well,
online.
I mean, it's coming on the back of the US where, you know, the last 3-4 years we've seen a lot of different online lifestyle, especially publications coming on board. But I think Australia's been quite far behind with that. They've been far behind with a lot of different, like the movie area, you know, there's not that many movie review sites. We've got the big boys like IGN and all that kind of stuff. They come in with things, but there's not that many homegrown, I suppose, talent. I would say I watched a little video that she put up, and I just want, so many people get it wrong, you know, just move the webcam down a little bit more. That's all I'm going to say. Because they don't seem to, when people do YouTube videos, they seem to focus on it wrong. They don't seem to actually realise that it's still like somebody's going to watch it on a screen. You have to still frame yourself properly. you know, and I mean, that's what I do for a living. I give this advice to my clients: frame yourself properly. It's the best way to do it. Watch TV, see how they do it properly, then do it right.
I suppose the thing is it's an opportunity those early days before she finds the audience to make a few mistakes.
Absolutely, and that's the best way to do it. And look, best of luck to her. I think we need people with more, I suppose, and those with the skill from the magazine and stuff to actually come on board and try and launch proper ones.
And you know, I must admit, I mean, there've been a few in that space. So, for instance, Mia Friedman's probably been going for more than a year now. Yep. Mamma Mia, and I wasn't sure whether that would make it or not. Just purely, I wasn't sure if the business model was there. But it does look to me like that's found its feet. This site looks great.
Actually. It does actually. So it's well put together.
And you know, and my instinct thing is actually I think that might work. Whereas Naomi Robson, when she launched hers, you know. Best of luck to her, but my sort of sense was the model wasn't there, and looking at it, you know, nearly a year
actually,
later.
I think
it's
that one of the problems
working.
Was I don't think the following was there. I don't think people actually had a lot of respect for her. And if they don't, if people don't really know you and you launch, then you've got the potential. But if you've already got negative publicity against you, chances are people aren't going to go watch you.
That's it's very personality based. Mia Friedman, and by the look of her video, Paula has a fantastic personality.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very honest, very self-deprecating, and like you say, both of those other sites look so much better than Naomi's. And I believe she hasn't blogged on there for about 6 months.
No, yeah, it looks odd. I mean, there's some what looks like syndicated content still going up, because I had a look at the Twitter feed this week, and you know, new stuff is still being tweeted. But yeah, there's been no new videos. I you know, I think it was giving it a go, but maybe thinking the audience would find her. And
but it never felt as if she was. The problem is, she went online. I think whoever was behind it went online expecting people to flock to it, and that they wouldn't actually have to do any work to get the crowds. And that's not the way it goes. Online, you build it by engaging.
Yeah, it's a different model, isn't it? And
yeah.
I think actually for, you know, for people who sort of, you know, come through a sort of more traditional journalism where, you know, you own the means of production, you hand it to people, it's a totally different discipline, yeah. Really.
And you've got to engage each of the new technologies as they come along, which yeah. Mia Friedman's done terrifically. Yeah. She's a prolific tweeter and a smart and funny tweeter.
Yeah, she's got a good handle when she does it. I mean, she really engages with people and gets involved, and she you know, and she responds. I don't think I've ever seen Naomi respond.
No,
funnily enough, I had a little incident this week when I was having a discussion. I thought it was strange that FHM used Ruby Rose on the front cover of their magazine, because I've been an FHM reader since 93, I think, when it was a man on the cover, and then around 96 they changed to the whole female in the cover format. And I think this is the first time I've ever seen a lesbian on the cover. Which, and I actually said to him, I said, well, it's strange because I didn't realise that was your demographic has always been young teenage boys, and you put on an attainable per se person on the cover. So the moment you put a lesbian on the cover, that's not attainable. So I was just curious as to the thought process behind that, and yeah, they actually responded on Twitter saying, "Well, yeah, but isn't she gorgeous?" And I was like,
"That's sometimes the nuance taken out of the Twitter conversation, isn't it?"
So yeah, it was just, and that's an interesting one. They're engaging, but I found it strange that. They did. I guess I felt as though they missed the mark on that one.
I thought every teenage boy's fantasy, though, was to see a lesbian.
No, bisexual.
Oh, I see. Right.
Attainable. That's the key.
Before we go too far down this, like, what other sites do you tend to spend time looking at, Tracy?
Oh, look, I'm a news nerd, so I'm constantly on the Huffington Post, The Punch, news.com.au, SMH, Guardian, all those ones.
Wired?
I haven't looked at Wired.
Well, that's
thank you
techie.
For the recommendation.
Wired's not techie. Wired's very it's techie, but lifestyle.
Do you know the issue I have with Wired is I'm not sure I know what it stands for anymore. You know, because I, you know, maybe when I, and funny thing is, this is something about the nature of magazines and human nature or something. I subscribe to Wired out of the US. Each year they renew via credit card my subscription. I moved house 3 years ago. It still goes to my old address. I never see it.
Why haven't you changed your address?
Because it's in the US and it's hard work. Why don't and I you can't just remember my details.
See, I download it on. I've got it on my iPad, well, so I read it every month on my iPad.
Well, absolutely, and I, you know, but that's the thing. I'm somehow technically.
Somebody's
a
not bought you an iPad
yeah.
as a gift
but,
yet.
Yeah, then. But but anyway, I suppose the wider point I'm trying to make is that I stopped caring enough about Word because I wasn't sure whether it was a lifestyle magazine or telling you about the interesting and exciting stuff that was happening online. And maybe it was just of its time five years
ago. Do you read it online every day?
No.
Oh, see, I read it. Yeah. Every day I read it. It's my first.
Yeah, but my point is 5 years ago, that magazine was all. It was talking about the fast developments in online. Every single time,
yep.
There were four or five really significant things each month. And actually, you know, you could make the argument that the last significant thing to happen or seem to happen was Foursquare.
Yep.
So that, you know, the speed of new things coming along.
They did have the CEO of Foursquare on the magazine five months ago.
Yeah, no, sure. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, 4 or 5 months ago. But what I'm getting at is that I'm not sure that as a monthly package it works.
That's why it works. I find it works as a monthly package because there's a lot of good unique stories in it. But I check it daily because there's a lot of good stories on it. And it is more as tech, but lifestyle, but and it's the future of tech online, which I think's that's where all the publications are. You know, everybody needs to be ahead of the game or know what the next big thing is. And I think Wired is that stepping stone for a lot of people to see what's coming.
Well, Tracy, when was the last time you walked into a newsagent and bought a magazine?
That's a very good question. I'm not much of a magazine reader, but no, I do it all online now.
It has. It's changed.
I mean, oh, yeah.
Do you know, each week Scott kind of nags me to get an iPad and I sort of push back. But the launch of the Economist iPad, the fact that it will probably be available sort of 24 hours earlier than usually you can buy the copy at the weekend.
You like that?
That's got me teetering. That has got me teetering on finally buying
one. Well, I downloaded an app that I read called, it's called Audio Note, I think it is. I'll just check, actually. And it is phenomenal for productivity. So it records an entire conversation when you're in a meeting, but you can write notes on it at the same time, and it puts the notes at the time that you're recording it.
Okay.
So then you can just go to that point to listen into what the note was.
That is a good idea, isn't it? For journalists, that'd be
exactly
quite cool as well.
For journalists, that's phenomenal.
Yeah. Well, and next we stay with journalism and talk about changes at Fairfax. So massive upheaval at Fairfax this week with Brian McCarthy, or rather ironically, I see that we've typoed it as Brain McCarthy, resigning, and Greg Highwood stepping into the acting CEO role. Now, Scott, for one of the things I actually really liked about this is having an ex-journalist back at the helm.
Yeah, it feels nice, doesn't it? It made me feel a bit warm inside, I have to admit. I kind of went, oh, good, somebody who actually has stepped through the process and knows it's not just about money. I mean, ultimately, it's not. Mm. You know, the reason most of us become journalists is because we want to get some good stories out there. And, you know, hopefully this will help grow.
What would you do with Fairfax if you were in charge?
Look, I'd integrate it personally. Not that I know anything about the business side of the media, but it seems to me, having just worked at 2UE, and obviously I'm not going to bite the hand that feeds me, but it,
2UE it's a, being a Fairfax station.
Precisely. But it surprises me that on air we don't use Sydney Morning Herald journalists all the time. I mean, I work at News Limited, so I'm a little bit of a traitor, and occasionally I'll speak to some of my colleagues from News Limited, but it makes more sense to integrate all their platforms.
Yeah. Yeah, and hopefully that will happen. You know, I think they really need to realise that they've got so much at their disposal, and every area should be utilised in other areas. Mm. I mean, that makes sense. Every other company in the world does that, so what makes media any different?
Well, really, there's no such thing as a newspaper or a radio station or a TV station anymore. They're all multimedia outlets.
Yeah, just a media hub, you know, and you've got to utilise the right means.
I think what we are going to see is, just in terms of personnel and organisation, a lot of change happening.
Well, good. Mm. Well, look, and don't get me wrong, I still think that you need a business head on you to do the job right, but hopefully he can juggle both and get it right.
Well, next we talk about the new Nissan ad. So it's all about downsizing with the new Nissan, apparently. Their new ad for the Micra was created by Wybin TBWA Tequila. Now, this is one of those ones, sometimes we do play clips from the ads, but there's no point, as this one's just a piece of music. Now, Scott, this one caught your eye, so maybe describe the ad first of all.
Yeah, it's just a new Nissan Micra, which looks like a little bit of a bubble. Driving around the city, but seems to know all the shortcuts. Cuts through.
There are lots of bits of CGI arrows.
Yeah, does a U-turn, and then obviously does a U-turn the moment water bursts out of a mains for some bizarre reason. It didn't connect with me at all. But it didn't connect because I felt like it wasn't about the car, it was about the driver. I felt like the driver knew all the shortcuts, not the car. So you're not focusing on a car, you're focusing on the driver's ability to know the city. And that's how I perceived the advert.
Yeah, it didn't connect with me, but for a different reason. Ah. And I think it's all down to this quote by, and I apologise to Andrew Scott in advance, talking about the main aim for the campaign was to utilise modern music and colourful graphics, you know, to get a younger audience. And I thought, this just sounds like someone who's really out of touch with a younger audience trying to do a funky young ad, because it didn't look too groovy to me.
It didn't.
I think there is also, probably in fairness, the ad agency, there's a separate art to writing the press release about your ad.
Yes.
And you do, and you know, and there's very much a formula. So what tends to happen is, generally most big campaigns break on a sort of over the weekend, on a Sunday night. So generally the press release will arrive on the Friday morning, and the kind of formula is brand X is launching, you know, product Y with the ad written by agency Z. First of all, you obviously have to quote the client so that the client feels good about it. But then, yeah, there's that painfully earnest quote from the executive creative director on the piece of insight and genius they've had, and the problem is, you know, if you were the client and the agency didn't take themselves and what they did seriously, then you'd be unhappy. But it does, the danger is you start sounding like you think you're doing sort of, you know, rocket surgery or something to
and it's just an act. Yeah, it's funny because I think they've done some good ads. The whole TVWA, Wyman Tequila, that whole massive thing, which I should point out is in the building, in the same building as I work. And actually,
I'm not sure that counts as a declaration of interest as such.
Yeah, well, please apologize.
Okay, and then I'll say that I work for Fleischmann, and Wyman Tequila are also part of Omnicom, which is our parent group. So in a way, I am affiliated with them. So I should point that out.
Well, I'm glad you went out of the way to slag off their ad then.
No, I didn't say I slag off their ad. I said it just didn't connect with me personally. See, there's a difference there, Tim. What I would say is that some ad agencies do need to hire a good PR agency, because I think that they sometimes can't write press releases really well.
No, they can't. It's a very different skill. I guess, Trace, from your point of view, sort of, you know, always on the journalistic side, but have there sort of been times when you've had those pressures from commercial sort of impinge?
Do you know, the only time it's ever happened in 20 years was when I worked at Channel 9 in Melbourne, and this was literally 18 years ago, and I was doing a story on people protesting against a McDonald's being built in a particularly sort of green area, and we had pressure from McDonald's and we dropped the story, and that is the only time in 20 years. But, of course, it didn't surprise me that it was McDonald's.
Yeah, I...
What, the whole McCafe thing?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh,
exactly.
Yeah. Oh, the Carrie Bickmore clip. Have you seen the Carrie Bickmore clip?
I haven't. I read about it.
Yeah, it's actually worth seeking out. Now, the only reason I haven't written about it on Mumbrella so far is because it rarely, and I think it's because of, you know, probably very rigorously enforced copyright issues by Harpo Productions, you can't embed it from YouTube. It's not on YouTube, so you've got to go to the Oprah website itself. But yeah, the Carrie Bickmore Guide to Australia, of which, you know, everyone in Australia has all of their business meetings in cafes where they drink McLattes, is not good. There's been quite a, for her credibility as well, there's been a bit of a backlash on Twitter, I've seen.
Yeah, I also put another disclaimer out there that Fleischmann Herald in the US... were involved in bringing Oprah over to Australia. I think they were involved working with Tourism Australia and kind of formulated the idea to bring her over, which is quite interesting. Arrived this week.
She did. She arrived yesterday, on Wednesday. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes. And straight off to, I think, Hamilton Island, or one of the...
best job in the world.
One of the islands now. Well, it certainly is. Well, next, a slight slip of the tongue.
What's happening in the course of the next hour? Well, first up after the news, we're going to be talking to Jeremy Hunt, the Culture Secretary, about broadband. It's 8 o'clock on Monday, the 6th of December. American officials have condemned WikiLeaks after the website published a list of hundreds of facilities said to be vital for American security. Every community in Britain has been promised that it'll have access to the fastest broadband networks within 5 years. Excuse me. And Egypt has called in international shark experts to investigate a series of attacks in the Red Sea. Pardon me, coughing fit. The news comes from Rory Morrison.
In perhaps its most controversial release yet...
So that was the BBC's Jim Naughtie on the BBC flagship morning radio show today.
Is that how he pronounces it?
I like to think, yes, it's the it's the Scot in me. But I'm sure that...
Naughtie. Naughtie.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, come on.
You said Naughtie.
Well, I just like the fact that it sounds a bit like naughty as well, considering what it was he said. Tracy, you've had many, many hours live on air. What's your worst blooper?
I actually fainted while I was reading the weather in Melbourne for Channel 10 in the early 90s.
Wow.
Pre-YouTube.
Pre-YouTube,
luckily.
Which is fortunate.
Is it still out there, though, somewhere?
I hope not. I sincerely hope not.
So
I had
a terrible
lurgy at the time, and I was breathing through my nose instead of my mouth, and I hyperventilated. But because I'd never hyperventilated before, I had no idea what was coming. I just thought, gee, I'm feeling a bit lightheaded. That's unusual. Next thing I knew, I wake up, and I'm lying on the studio floor, and the shot had cut to the two newsreaders at the time, who were David and Joe Pearson, and they just were just looking down at the floor in horror, thinking she's dead. And look, the lovely thing was I got a lot of letters. This is pre-email, of course. Letters of, you know, flu cures, you know, cures for the cold and poor Tracy and flowers and stuff. So the viewers were very kind, but I was mortified.
Well,
anybody has that coffee, feel free to drop it off to at Mumbrella.
Yes, no, we'll happily get that one back onto YouTube where it belongs. Well, next up, we stay on the subject of radio.
But, oh, wait, Have you done any bloopers?
None that I can immediately think of.
Because you did radio for a while, did you not?
Can you think? Yeah, but it was little radio. It was in Dubai.
You can still make bloopers on little radio.
Yeah. No, none that I can immediately think of, actually. No, not hilarious. Just you know, mild incompetence.
I suppose, as a journalist point of view, I did a little blooper when I was on the phone to my girlfriend at one point when there was a live news report going on behind me, and it was about job losses, and I was actually on the phone talking to my girlfriend about something, and my girlfriend at the time, and she'd made a joke, and I was laughing, but I'm in the background of their footage laughing. So I went, oh, I've got another call coming in, hold on. I went, hello, and my editor's like, get out the fucking way of the BBC camera report. And I'm like, uh-oh. Okay.
Well, next we do stick with radio, and we'll talk about advertising revenue back on the rise. So radio advertising revenue has continued to rise, and the significant point that I think we've hit is that it's now a year of radio revenues being on the rise, which sort of suggests, and this has been, you know, each month compared to the same month the year before, which is what suggests to me that actually radio is kind of through the worst. So, you know, November of last year we had also been on the up, and this is the second November running, which is a very long way of explaining a very simple point. Scott, wearing your PR hat, radio's strength as a communication medium.
As I've said in the past, everybody listens to it in a car. Mm. You know, that's the best thing. It's why it will, you know, if TV dies out or TV changes what it is to this whole, you know, access on demand, radio will still always have a place, because people will always, you know, need to listen to something when they're working, or they need something that they can't focus on with their eyes, but they will need their ears.
And Tracy, will you be doing live reads?
I will be doing live reads. I'll put on my special live read voice as well.
That must be an adjustment process for the journalists when they do their first live read.
Look, it is, because editorial and advertising are normally, you know, never the twain shall meet. So it will be interesting. But I equally realise that somehow we have to pay for all of our wages and keep the business going. Mm. I just want to pick up on something you said before about the growth of radio, people being in their cars. And I think that's why radio in Sydney will always do well, while we still have not much road infrastructure. But also, communities are disintegrating and people are looking for that intimate voice. I mean, people are lonely. Radio provides company, you know. So I think it will continue to grow. And in fact, the figures in the States are showing it'll grow pretty well in the next year.
Well, finally, we'll be talking WikiLeaks. Now, WikiLeaks has been all over the news. Unfortunately, the way that Twitter measures breaking and new trends means that because people are talking about it so much all the time, it's not even trending. Well,
that's not actually true. I'll now just point out something else.
Well, have a go.
What has been trending is Cablegate.
Well, that's because it's a new phrase.
Yes, but Cablegate's also trending because they asked, WikiLeaks said, use the term Cablegate.
But let me explain to you why it's not been trending. It's because the algorithm for Twitter... God, I'm sorry that I'm being so trivial here. The algorithm
for
Twitter...
I just want to point out, I think that Twitter's actually down right now because Twitter shut down Anon's account, Anonymous being the group from 4chan, and they just said, sorry, Twitter, you shut down our account. It's attack time about 15 minutes ago, and looking at Twitter, it seems to be down right now.
This is as we record this on
Thursday.
This is
brave new world.
It is. We should probably just give it a little bit of context for those who haven't been catching up on all of the WikiLeaks stuff. Tracy, what do you... The problem is there's so many different stories. What do you see as the kind of central thread of this WikiLeaks?
The central thread of it is freedom of information, which underpins all of our democracies. I think Julian Assange is a hero, frankly. And he does, again, we're talking about, you know, people polarising opinion. I'm obviously a big fan of his. And I think Julia Gillard's made an enormous mistake by criticising him and saying he's done something illegal, which is absurd. And I do think this could end up being her David Hicks.
Well, I think that my issue is the US government saying it's illegal. You know, this whole issue with the Swedish government at the moment, the fact that this whole court case seems to be really unusual. Some of the cables that came out show that the US put pressure on Sweden to do with the Pirate Bay, which obviously failed for them.
Pirate Bang being the file sharing site.
Because the RIAA and the MIAA in America have massive influence over the government in the US.
The RIAA?
Recording Industry Association of America and the Movie Industry, or whatever it is. And they, you know, because they don't want file sharing to happen. Funnily enough, you know, if the music industry had actually let Napster exist and actually helped grow it, you know, music today would probably be, people would be buying a lot more music. And I think the movie industry and the TV industry have got the potential to go down that dark route as well, where they're, you know, they're attacking people for downloading, where they should be making it easier for people to access what they want when they want it.
I'll tell you where I feel a bit conflicted as a journalist, because I do think brilliant disclosure, all of those things, is we've seen the big sort of big national, international news sites form their own views on what should and shouldn't be shared. So the journalists are...
Oh, interesting.
They're having to take that decision on, okay, this compromises security, this doesn't. So when The Guardian or The New York Times or whatever, you know, they have the early access to the information, they decide what's safe and what's not.
Yeah.
So they're making the same decisions as the governments, but they're just leaning towards more disclosure, not full disclosure.
You know, and WikiLeaks worked with each of those news establishments and said, you know... There is names blacked out on a lot of the stuff that they gave them, you know, to ensure that people didn't get, you know, everybody's names and all that kind of stuff. You know, they did edit the documents themselves and worked with the different newspaper organisations for their information to go out there. Now, there's also the interesting fact of the 1.4 gigabyte file on the Pirate Bay and other sharing sites that has 256-bit encryption, and that should anything happen to Julian Assange, the password will be released. And that... I read that it's got all the names unblocked, and it has every document for everyone, and it has, and I suppose there's other stuff. And it's quite interesting that I suppose one of the things that Julian Assange said recently is that the next group he's attacking is the banks.
Well, they said that they'll release some information at the US bank. But Tracy, wearing your news editor hat, not that you, as far as I know, have been a news editor, do you go down the full disclosure of everything route, or the journalist's job is to protect security when lives are at risk route?
No, I'll go down the full disclosure route.
Because sources are confidential sources whose lives are in danger are named, for instance.
This is where it's a difficult area. But still, I mean, your responsibility as a journalist is to release these things. You can't say, I'm going to be a gatekeeper in the same way that the government is the gatekeeper.
But one thing I'll say is only if it's in the public interest.
Oh, precisely, is the journalist imprimatur anyway.
And I think that's one of the things that a lot of people seem to think that, oh, WikiLeaks are this is, you know, it's not in the public interest. One of the most interesting stories, funnily enough, I read it on Boing Boing, the blogger site. They've got an interview with a German man who was kidnapped by the CIA, who was tortured for, I think, 2 months. He was dumped in another country, and the Cablegate stuff, the WikiLeaks revealed that the American government put pressure on the German police not to investigate the case. And all this guy had done was had the same name as another terrorist. So, you know, and he's got his news stories now on, you know, it's going to interview with him about all the torture they did to him simply because he had the same name, and the US pressured them not to follow it. His wife and kids didn't know where he was missing, you know, and that's the kind of stuff that needs to be revealed.
Yeah, totally. But I suppose it's, you know, similarly, generally, I think in most countries, for instance, there's an informal agreement between journalists and the police that say there's a kidnapping going on, they won't report it until it's resolved and things like that. You know, so there are journalistic conventions that say sometimes the media will know things and not put them into the public domain.
Oh, this was a missing person. Yes, they didn't know he'd been kidnapped.
I agree. But I think, you know, what we're seeing more widely is journalists taking decisions about what's in the public interest. And the question is, you know, why is it our right as journalists to make the decision rather than the people in the security forces, for instance?
Yeah, look, it's not really necessarily our right to make those decisions, but that always has been the role of the media. And like you say, it's a very grey area and the line can be shifted. And it's a big decision to make.
Because somebody needs to watch the watchers.
Exactly.
You know, and that's...
Yes.
Exactly.
But then who watches the watchers?
That's what the Press Complaints Commission is for, the toothless tiger.
yes, but, the Press Council,
yeah, I agree, but I think that one of the things is, and I've said this on Twitter a few times, I think that governments are failing to realise they're for the people a lot of the time these days. They seem to think they're for themselves. But ultimately, they're accountable to the people of the country that voted them in. And fair enough that most countries these days have a tiny minority, of people voting them in, but do you know what? You're still accountable to 100% of those people. Mm. And yes, you're going to make decisions on a daily basis that will affect everybody's lives or affect a few of those people's lives. And yes, you're going to make decisions that have people killed. However, you still have a right to make sure that you do not lie to your people. And what's been coming across in these cables have been released, is that the US government have been lying to their people.
Well, we're getting slightly away from the media point.
Sorry,
of
yes,
that one.
Yeah.
But so just back onto who watches the watchers. The public does. If you're the head of a media organisation, you publish something that puts people's lives at risk, there will be backlash from your audience.
Yeah.
And they'll stop buying your newspapers or you're listening to your radio stations. So ultimately, the public are the arbiters.
And maybe just one final point on the whole sort of WikiLeaks debate. What we're also seeing is brands coming under attack when when they found themselves wading in. So, for instance, you know, we've seen it with MasterCard has been the big example this week, where they run they have been offering the means of making donations to WikiLeaks. They stopped and pulled back and are now coming under attack as a result. And it's kind of, you know, it's reported online from the likes of, Associated Press, pointing out that you can still make donations to the likes of the Ku Klux Klan. So clearly there's a double standard.
Yeah.
But
I think it was Joe Lieberman, the US
senator,
who said, you know, companies would want to distance themselves from WikiLeaks. That was his quote. And I think that's...
Gee, that's subtle.
Yeah, exactly. They, you know, they want to distance themselves. And it'll be interesting to see the next steps and what happens in all this.
But the question is, you know, where brands can be, if they offend a group of, you know, anonymous activists, can find their site being taken down with its, you know, MasterCard under attack. And I think their official line is that the site's slow but isn't down. You know, we're seeing Twitter running down by the looks of it.
Well, Visa and MasterCard, I think, are down today. But it was reported in the news anyway.
Where do we go from there, though?
Look, I don't think it's just a small group of anarchists, okay? I know Anonymous, 4chan are behind it, but this is a global protest against censorship. I think most people you spoke to would support this protest movement.
Mm. Well, that is where we have to leave it. That's all for today. Thank you to my co-host, Scott Rohde.
Thanks, Tim.
And to our guest for today, Tracy Spicer.
Thanks, it was fun.
And good luck on 2UE next week. Thank you also to CBS Interactive for use of their studios. Production was by Georgina Pearson. That was The Mumbrella Cast. I'm Tim Burrows. Toodle-pip.